Hello, everybody. It's great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler. I'm the CEO, president, and founder of GSD, Get You Done Venture Studios, a premier AI and quantum venture studio and family office located in Florida and California. I'm a 17-time serial entrepreneur with several unicorns under the belt. I was on the original management team at Click Software, which was sold to Salesforce for $1.35 billion. Also, Eva.ai, an AI HR tech company that co-founded with Dr. David Yang. We believe at GSD that intellectual capacity is evenly spread, but opportunities are not. And with that, I would like to introduce my incredible guest today. You know, our show is where we explore the future of insurance, healthcare, AI, and business. Choose depending upon where you are. We love AI. And as many of you know, I was a co-founder of Zemply, which is a company from Stanford University that did remote patient monitoring. So Alex is a Y Combinator, has a Y Combinator startup called CareCycle that's handled over 1.2 million conversations over AEP 2024. Their platform is transforming how agencies manage sales, retention, renewals, all while helping licensed agents focus on what they do best, building relationships and writing new business. In this episode, I'd like to break down how voice AI can 10x your book without growing your team, the difference between automation and authentic engagement, and why the most successful agencies of the future will be the ones that embrace AI or go out of business. So with that, I'd like to bring Alex on board.
Hey, glad to be here.
So, you know, so tell us a little, give me your elevator pitch on CareCycle.
Yeah, so CareCycle is a system of voice AI team members for Medicare agencies. They handle every non-licensed agent task in the customer journey. So that includes, say, pre-qualification before a customer speaks with a licensed agent, and a lot of post-enrollment engagement, which without CareCycle not only wasn't automated, but it also wasn't necessarily happening with humans. So we're introducing a lot of net new touch points into that customer journey.
So how did the idea for, I mean, you're in Canada, right, in Calgary. So how did the idea of CareCycle come about? And what pain points of Medicare or ACA space were you most focused on solving?
Yeah, so I had a circuitous path, you could say, to get here. So originally from a small town in Canada, in Alberta, went to school on the West Coast here in Vancouver, and had the opportunity actually to do PR for global companies and primarily Chinese companies out of New York. Now, through that, I ended up meeting this company called AI Rudder back in 2021 and was really fascinated by what they do. So they were a very early voice AI company in the space, and they were horizontal. So I ended up joining and leading their U.S. team as the first hire. This is just pre-ChatGPT, and decided to take a huge bet on voice AI technology, specifically conversational AI as, you know, the final interface. Now, at AI Rudder, we got a lot of traction very quickly with early adopters, but what I always noticed is we were kind of an inch deep, mile wide on a lot of our solutions. So we would, for example, be in a call with a bank, and then a call with a law firm, and then a call with a home services private equity roll-up that wanted us to build voice AI for their pest control companies, all within one day. And so really where CareCycle came is just this tension, this hard time sleeping at night for a few years in horizontal voice AI, just seeing the writing on the wall as this technology proliferates. It's really powerful to have the technology, but what's more powerful than the technology itself is if you can embed very specific industry knowledge into that technology to create an actual useful solution. So we experimented quite a lot, and we ended up landing in Medicare. We found that the pain points were both more hidden and more painful than we had anticipated from the outside in. There was a massive willingness to pay, and also, frankly, we really enjoyed working with our customers in Medicare more than our customers in other verticals. So
why
we decided
that?
To take a bet. You know, it's a very fascinating industry. It's very fragmented. So you've got a few very large players and then a very long, long tail of mom and pops all over the country. So that being said, they're sales organizations. So they're very real time. They're very focused. They're very intense. So even the small mom and pop ones, they They care a great deal about monitoring their metrics, and they actually value technology. I've heard from other software businesses and adjacent healthcare spaces that Medicare agencies are bad customers of software. I couldn't disagree more. I think they were great thought partners, very creative and very willing to experiment, and also just sticklers for metrics. But they're willing to move fast on deals and willing to give honest feedback. And we get to speak with people all over the country, which is an opportunity I had never had previously, and until selling to folks, in Arkansas or Mississippi. It's a cultural experience for me.
Now, how big was your town in Canada?
10,000 people.
Now, were you north? Were there wild animals? Did you have moose and mountain lions and all that? Was it that wild, like up at Banff, or how was it growing up there?
To an extent. So I was from a very interesting town called Brooks, and it's a really, really special place in the world, actually. It's a small town in Canada, southeastern Alberta. So it's actually positioned in a desert in the summer. Some of the landscape would look something more reminiscent of like in Arizona. But it's very unique because a large chunk of the population is now new immigrants from all over the world. And so I grew
Why
up
is
in a
that?
surprisingly international space. There's a few different things. Oil and gas industry is definitely one of them. There's also a massive meatpacking facility there, so a feedlot. And so it brings people from all over the world who mostly, are highly educated people elsewhere. They're veterinarians, they're doctors, they're engineers, but they want to move to North America. They want to move to Canada for their young kids, to start a new life. And I grew up with those young kids who had, just gotten here from wherever, Somalia, for example.
Now, wait
So
a minute,
very
you come
cool.
from Somalia to that part of Canada. It's a little bit colder, isn't it? The Chinook winds and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know
What
how
did
on
they do
earth they
when they
coped with
what
it.
did they do when they first saw a car that has a cord hanging out to heat the body, the block? What did they do? Like,
Yeah.
they probably said, "Hey, listen, this thing's got a problem. You send me a bad car, right? The
Yeah,
wires are..."
I hope they got a fair warning before they went out there.
Yeah, no, I remember
There's no
coming up
preparing
there,
for
and it
that.
was so cold, it was unbelievable. Like,
Yeah.
really cold, actually. So, you went through Y Combinator, and how did Y Combinator help you?
So, in a sentence, Y Combinator was permission to dream bigger for us. So we had done about 70K in revenue our first month. This was October last year. We were honestly intending on bootstrapping this, quite hesitant to take on venture money. I started my career in venture for a short period of time after graduating. So I have quite mixed feelings about the value proposition. Once we got in, I think it let us know that there are perhaps different ways of building this thing where you can be more long-term oriented. As they say, play long-term games with long-term people. So that's really what Y Combinator did for us. The advice, and they'll be the first to say this, is honestly incredibly intuitive and somewhat generic. So there's no magical secret sauce that they give you in terms of advice, but what they do is they force you to practice it. And in a world of entrepreneurship where execution matters much more than theory, I think that's the most valuable thing that they can give folks.
You know, I've been building startups in Silicon Valley 44 years, 17 startups and a couple of unicorns. And there's really three things, right? And sometimes people forget this. We had a conversation before the show, but there's operational expertise, access to capital, network, and contacts. And if you have those three in a resilient team, any company can be pivoted to become a unicorn. The problem is most people also don't understand that this is like a very closed club, right? The 99% of the wealth is 1% of the population, like we talked about in the beginning of this. Well, guess what? They're limited partners in every one of the funds, virtually. And so what happens is they're the one that controls the money. The family offices are much more aggressive right now than many of the VCs, much more. In fact, in certain types of biotech, there are 85% of the deals are done by families right now. They're getting more aggressive. And I know that because, we were with the families. We're one of the small family offices. right? And sometimes people forget it. They don't think differently. It's quite interesting. And then the other thing is you go down through a lot of these situations and people will tell you about how to build a unicorn. They've never done it. It's like going up and, you know, going into, say, listen, you know, I got to go down through and my neck bothers me. I've got a lump on my neck. And you go into the doctor and says, I'm a podiatrist. I can fix a bunion on your toe. You know what I mean? It's crazy. Like, seriously, the average VC is between 24 and 33. They never built a company, only 10%. Yet they're trying to tell you how to do it. And they have degrees from places like Waterloo, right, where they've gone to school and finance. So they're doing a financial model, but that's not how you build a unicorn. Then the other thing is they say to you, you know, this is like being married, but an average VC meets with you about 2.8 hours. I don't know about you, but there's nobody I'd be marrying after 2.8 hours. I don't care who it is. You know, they're not going to happen. So why in the world? It's crazy, actually. You know, and I just came back from South Korea with, I was with Plug and Play. So I went over and they asked me to be a speaker and an investor at one of their conferences. And there were thousands, I guess 12,000 people or so at this event. And worldwide, it's all the same. Everything comes together as one. The Germans have a phrase, Gestalt, the sum of the parts equal the whole. So the families are the ones, you know, that actually control it. And most people don't, they never get to that point. It's very interesting to me, you know, that it's like selling, right? You got to go to the top. So why would you sell in the interim, in the middle, when you can go to the top? So, I mean, part of it's because it's hard to get to the families, right? Some of the families we just talked about, it's really hard to get to them unless you know them.
100%.
So you mentioned that licensed agents need to spend their time. So by the way, I started the first generative AI company, Pre-Transformer Models, in 2016. You can see it in TechCrunch. I've been in AI 29 years, so expert systems to today. So know a little bit about it. And the one thing, you know, so you mentioned that licensed agents need time to spend their time writing new business. What are the biggest inefficiencies? By the way, my AI is asking the questions. So I have 14 large language models active as a team. And it's listening to our conversations, pulling stuff about you out there right now. So it says, what are the biggest inefficiencies in current Medicare sales and retention workflows?
Yeah, awesome. I love that, by the way. Great tooling. Simply put, Medicare agencies are sales organizations, right? And so they're incentivized to write new policies. Problem is, one of the most compelling things about doing Medicare distribution is retention and renewals revenue. So you can think of it as a recurring revenue business, much like a SaaS. So what do we focus so much on in SaaS? Churn. I mean, growth matters, but if you've got really high churn in, say, a consumer SaaS app, you say, you know, plug the hole in the boat first. The Medicare distribution mechanism is the agency business has been operating by and large on an assumption that high churn rates are just a cost of doing business. It's just a fact of the matter. And so, you know, coming from the outside in into this industry, I saw this as just a glaring issue. I mean, these businesses are growing at best linearly when they could have an opportunity to really grow exponentially if they focus on the fundamentals.
Based on the population. But here's another thing. Tell me what you think about this. It's very interesting for me. I met with the CEO of one of the former CEO of one of the largest health insurance companies in the U.S., actually in North America. And one of the things that was very interesting for me, we had a conversation. I said, dude, why in the hell did we get down through and, you know, like I had full body stem cell replacement. I had 100 million stem cells twice put in my body. So why don't we look at these innovative approaches to medicine? And he said a very interesting conversation. He said, because really the life insurance companies should be the ones handling healthcare because they care about you living longer, right? It was very interesting. You know, we got our priorities kind of screwy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're in Saskatchewan and you're trying to figure out how to do to get, you know, you have got cancer and you don't have access to Keytruda, immunotherapy. What do you do? It's crazy. Shouldn't we democratize the opportunity? I mean, you see that, I'm sure, coming from a small 10,000 person city, town, actually in Canada. But we got to democratize and get it out there. And that's one of the biggest challenges So just asked me, it said, how do missed calls and lack of follow-up actually translate into lost revenue or higher churn for agencies?
Yeah, so as sales organizations, the people on the phones are, they're incentivized to talk with new leads, right?
So yeah, because they make a, they make commission on their deals. They get 1 month worth of the payment, right? So they get 1 month premium. And so they're consistently trying to get new customers in. You know, they're not getting annuity business every month. That's the agency, right? But they're getting 1 month, I think, anyhow. I think that's how it works. So they always want to get more customers.
Yeah, there's various different compensation structures. And you have a, that's a phenomenal point, is the compensation structure for the individual agent will, you know, show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. It'll show you exactly how much post-enrollment engagement an individual agent does with their customers. But even then, it's a fundamental bandwidth constraint. So traditionally, unless you're a very, very large agency or carrier, it's very rare to have a dedicated customer service department or dedicated customer service people, because it's a thin margin sales business and marketing business to begin with, right? So what we've done is we've inserted voice AI agents in these critical moments in the customer journey, for example, immediately post-enrollment, for example, to do a welcome call and check in with folks, providing an opportunity for that customer to ask any questions about their plan that didn't get addressed. It knows what plan they have, it knows the summary of benefits, and has a human-in-the-loop mechanism that can serve more complex questions back to their licensed agent or round-robin it to the entire team to address. So we're kind of inserting this. It's not really a tool for humans to use like traditional SaaS. It's not completely AI employees taking over the whole company, as you know some are prophesizing will take place in B2B AI companies. But it's this beautiful right-in-between solution where we are augmenting human conversations. We're inventing new conversations that didn't exist with humans but should from first principles. Because we have unlimited bandwidth now with voice AI agents. So that's inclusive of things like missed calls. And after we crossed 1 million conversations, we actually did a white paper just studying to see if we could find any interesting insights. One of the most shocking ones to me was over 25% of inbound calls from Medicare beneficiaries to their agency are outside of business hours, either on the weekend, very early in the morning or in the evening. So if you could simply insert something, even if it's not that excellent, mm-hmm. just to help handle that 25%, that alone is a huge lift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just said you've actually handled 1.2 million conversations. I don't know if that's true or not. It came up with some numbers since AEP 2024. So it's
At 1.26 or something. So
yeah,
far
I don't know where
morning.
I pulled this stuff out. It's pulling it from somewhere, actually. Yeah. It's interesting. Can you break down I put about $2.5 million. I have a lab. I've got multi-agent large language models I've been working on for almost 3 years. So we build up, these omni-channel engines and things. So it's very interesting because everything's going to change. When you can take the speed of what you're doing with a conversation, and I can make it 1,000 times faster, right? And then when you take things like empathy and compassion and tokenize it using Skinnerian and Rogerian psychology, you can actually change the game, because what do we miss, right? It's empathy and compassion and caring about the people. It's not a pragmatic model. We got to make it so people understand it cares.
100%. And that needs to extend beyond just a simple system prompt.
I agree. And, yeah. You know, we're building those systems right now. So if you look, so DKI, I don't know if you know DKI. So DKI talks about parenting and parenting the AI. You know, you got to, just like you, right? You grew up in a small city, a small town, and your parents take good care of you and they teach you how to do things. It's the same thing with AI. It doesn't know. And if you don't put the guardrails up and say, listen, you should do this and shouldn't do that, what happens? Anything's possible. Not good, too, sometimes. So we got to get down through and parent it. Can you break down what makes your voice AI different from traditional IVRs or call centers?
Yeah, so, you know, another metric we got out of that white paper is over 50% of people expressed gratitude. They said thank you in very natural ways, you know, not just a transactional thank you, but Wow, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. That's one of the most important indicators to us that the conversation was helpful. And so just being in voice AI since 2021, I found that the dialogue is largely focused on the wrong narrative about voice AI design. The vast majority of dialogues about voice AI design are about how human is it? How human-like does it sound? Is it convincing?
Right.
Whereas in a B2B context, how human is it is secondary to us. We've always focused on how helpful is it. So if you have something that sounds kind of robotic, but it's tremendously helpful and knowledgeable about you, our big bet is that it would be better than a human who is less helpful. And obviously better than an unhelpful robot, which is what most people are used to. So for us, the purpose of making it sound incredibly human-like and lifelike is purely for suspending disbelief in the first sentence of the dialogue. If in the first sentence we can give someone the impression that this thing is intelligent and helpful and cares about me and capable of helping me, rather than, hey, this is a robot that's basically just buying time while I'm on hold, then we've won. And we can actually get into having a productive conversation to help that member. So there's a few things that differentiate us on that side. It really started with just surgical focus on good conversational design. What I found in my previous role is the greatest voice AI people focusing on the orchestration were also, it's just an org structure thing, writing a lot of the prompts. Because prompt engineering was still so janky.
Why is that, right? Think about it. Let's go back. Put my MBA professor hat on for a second. So think about it. Why does that happen? And, you know, you look at it, right? You got it. Technologists, for the most part, are building these systems, but they're not putting, I'm a clinical psychologist in addition to some other things. And we don't put the kind of things that we want as humans. When it goes to it's critically important. Because you want something like your grandmother. I write about this a lot. I've probably written 50 articles about this. You like your grandmother that has unconditional love, that cares about you. Remember growing up as a kid, you go over to your grandmother's house, you get away with anything. But, you know, she wouldn't get you, if it was something dangerous, she would put you in the right direction, but she also let you innovate and to explore. And those kind of things are critically important to the journey with AI. And we forget about it. And the AI needs to be parented, as I said, too, because if we don't parent it the right way, nothing good's going to happen. And I've seen some of the nothing good stuff, right? Jumping the guardrails. So we got to go down through and teach it. And we got to teach it like not as technologists, but as compassionate human beings.
Yeah, I think parents is such an incredibly strong analogy. I like to think that the current use cases of AI, to the extent that they're recursively fed into training data, we can think of really as the early childhood memories of large language models. So our interactions with them today are actually quite critical, as well as, I'd say, on an individual level, having presence in that training data. You know, if you haven't written, if your word is not cemented in the corpus of training data, for all intents and purposes, you might not exist from the perspective of future LLMs. So I think about that a lot as well. And I think we're at a very exciting inflection point, to your point about building empathetic AI and actually getting the right minds into the room to contribute to this problem. So early on, it was a vastly technical problem. You know, when Transformer was developed in 2017, or scaling infrastructure.
We were doing variational autoencoders, ladder networks, ontology, knowledge graphs, and all that. David Yang, the gazillionaire from Silicon Valley, was my partner in that company. And he was my CTO, and we were co-founders together, and I was a CEO. But we were talking about that then, 2016, you can see in TechCrunch, right? That was right before the Transformer models. And then we started building into that. And that's critically important. I talked about it a lot. Compassion and empathy. Something that cares, loves you, cares about you. You know, it's not just about the money. It's about, I mean, what kind of people do you like when you go out and you're going to buy something? You know, like people that you feel care about you. In fact, on this exact show, I had a 4-star admiral, the number two guy in the U.S. military, former number two guy, and the Joint Chiefs, Bill Owen. And I remember talking to Bill, and I said, you know, what's the secret? What are the secrets of leadership? And imagine, he was the number two guy in the entire U.S. military. He said, you know, empathy. And I said, can you give me an example? He said, during Operation Desert Storm, he was on an aircraft carrier, and he knew that 10% of his pilots would probably get shot down. And he was going to be one of the ones that would sign the letter to their parents, to their husbands or wives or kids. And a tear went down his cheek when he was on the monitors. And he said people throughout the aircraft carrier saw that, and they understood that he really cared. It's critically important. And to really care, not bullshit care. You know, everybody can be actors, but to really care. So, I love what you're doing. So it's asking me some more questions. It's asking me I don't know where it got this either. It says, what's behind the jump from a 1.7% to 2.8% conversion rate with after hour calls? Is that true?
That is true.
So, I have no idea where it pulled that out. It's like, it's got a bunch of questions now. It says, Gary, this is this my grandmother like thing, right? It's like, Gary, ask this. So it wants to know that. Why did that happen?
Yeah, so the mechanics of it are pretty simple. You know, let's say you're doing media buying on something like Facebook, driving inbound calls to your sales reps. It is difficult to control the exact hours, especially with Medicare beneficiaries, that those calls are coming in. Sometimes people will write down a phone number they see on a Facebook ad and call it later. So there's actually this uncontrolled volume on both sides, either before or after business hours. So rather than just having the line die or go to voicemail, which is traditionally what happens here, if you can just add a voice AI agent to help people out and maintain their level of intent from that ad and capture some next actions. So, you know, do some intake work with them that feels productive, feels valuable, schedule an appointment to call them back. And then we have agents that call that customer back the next day automatically based on their scheduled time, and then connect them with someone while maintaining context from both conversations. So we're going from maybe a voicemail or maybe a lead capture where you outbound dial that person the next day. They don't know who you are. They don't care. They're already talking to someone else, versus helping them at that highest moment of intent.
So now it's asking me, so it says, Gary, ask him about compliance, especially given the regulatory nature of the health insurance. So it's wondering how you're compliant.
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is also, Gary, one of the reasons we wanted to go into Medicare. So there are a lot of applications of voice AI. There are a lot of telephonic B2C industries that really need this technology. And I think a lot of them are going to be a bloodbath, frankly. We wanted to find the hardest problems we could solve with this technology. With, you know, in this case, regulatory moats are a component of that. It's frankly a very scary space to build AI technology in. You need to be incredibly careful. So we need to consider compliance with the CMS, their requirements, HIPAA compliance, of course, and then, of course, TCPA from the FCC. So we're making outbound calls to folks, which are very heavily regulated
and starting to differ by state. About that. How is it? How are they regulated? How do you do state-to-state compliance?
Yeah, so state-to-state compliance, for example, Texas just had a new ruling about redials and the hours that those redials can be made. So most states, between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. local time, you can call folks. Texas just changed it to 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. So now we have an exception in our code base just for Texas and guardrails built in.
So that? So you don't get sued or fined.
Yeah, we have legal counsel on staff just focused on TCPA. And we're also a part of a few groups in the insurance space specifically that are very gracious in, providing this information. So lawyers, folks in this area specifically, will frequently present. There's a lot to keep up with. And frankly, a lot of things are from the defense attorneys in this space. It's kind of alarmist most of the time. So you see one specific ruling that took place in a case, and they write a huge newsletter saying, you know, this is the end of this particular practice. And then you read further and you find out that this is a precedent, and It hasn't been actually discussed by any legislators yet. However, you can get ahead of things, and you can actually have a lot of lead time before any regulations change if you just keep in mind the precedents that get set by rulings in cases, in civil cases.
Got it. So we're coming up to the top of the show, Alex. So closing thoughts, and how can people get a hold of you? If you want to stay on for a few minutes afterwards, we can talk.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me, Gary. If you're interested in CareCycle, learning more, you can check us out at carecycle.ai. You can also check us out on LinkedIn. Marketing team is starting to get a lot more creative and fun with the videos. So we hope that you'll find them educational, certainly entertaining as well. And of course, if you're in the Medicare distribution space yourself, I'd love to discuss how our technology can help you out.
And how do we get a hold of you? LinkedIn, email, yeah. What's the best way?
LinkedIn is best. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today. And thanks to all my audience for joining one more time. GST presents Top Global Startups. My name is Gary Fowler, and I'm your host. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy. And I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition of Top Global Startups. Alex, I'll talk to you later. Thanks, everybody. And have a nice rest of the day.